Okay, so it's December 14th, 2016, and I'm Rick Hansen, and I'm very glad you're here to say it again. It's true. And you may know that we've been exploring mindfulness this year. And the Buddha described mindfulness, particularly applied to these four fundamental establishments or foundations of mindfulness, as the direct path to awakening. So it's this material, in terms of our best guess as to the original teachings of the Buddha, is very fundamental from the standpoint of practice. It's very practical. It's what we can do. It's how we help ourselves, how we see where we're going and where we've been, and you know what we can keep working on. And also, from time to time, if other people are asking us for something, it's a way we can perhaps help them too. So in terms of the four foundations, as you may know, the first one is the body. We come home to the body. We see what's going on in the body, in terms of the senses, but in particular the sensations of the body. In the second foundation, we track the hedonic tone of experience, or sometimes called the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Implicit in that is the relational, social, heart aspect of our experience. I think it's useful myself to kind of call it out and pay attention to that aspect of experience as well as relational. So we tend to move toward what's pleasant. We tend to move away from what's unpleasant. We tend to become sort of spacey and deluded about what's neutral. And you could say that with regard to what's heartfelt, we move into relatedness. So then in the third foundation, we track what the mind does with the hedonic tone of experience. Does it grasp onto what's pleasant? Does it go to war with what's unpleasant? Does it spin out from what's neutral? And does it cling to what's heartfelt? What are the general qualities of the mind? That's the third foundation. And then in the fourth foundation, it has to do with what are called dhammas or dharmas of various kinds, various themes in Buddhism. We have the Four Noble Truths, we have the aggregates of experience, the sense, major sense doors, the hindrances, and the factors of awakening. These sort of five fundamental lists of major things to pay attention to and to know about. Dhamma or dharma means both that which is, you know, reality, that which is true, as well as a believable account, a good account, a teaching about what is actually true. Recently, I've been exploring with you the awakening factors, the seven factors of awakening. Those factors are mindfulness, investigation, energy, bliss or joy or rapture, that's what I talked about last week, tranquility, deep concentration, actually that was last week, deep concentration, and equanimity. All right? Also, I hope to explore with you the hindrances. And thinking about this, I thought, oh, I'd wrap it all up in 2016 in a nice little bow, but what the heck? This stuff's important. These are the major lists. Who can leave out the Four Noble Truths? So I think I'll just kind of keep going, you know, to some extent into 2017, and then we'll keep seeing what's useful. All right? So tonight I want to talk about the second of those awakening factors, investigation. And I've heard it said from teachers I respect that in their lineage, of the seven, that's actually considered the most important, this quality of investigation. And I'd like to read to you the kind of the bit of teaching about it and then go into some detail and then open it up for discussion. Okay? Kind of the plan. All right. So in terms of how, as best we can gather, these are originally oral teachings that were repeated and memorized, passed down from person to person over probably two or three centuries, really, before surviving written records appeared. But it's our best guess as to what the Buddha taught and thought or his immediate contemporaries did. So this is the language of the teaching, which I'm going to update a little in terms of modern gender language. So here we go. If the investigation of dhammas, awakening factor, is present in you, you know there is the investigation of dhammas, awakening factor, in me. You're aware that it's there. if the investigation of Dhamma's awakening factor is not present in you, you know there is no investigation of Dhamma's awakening factor in me. You know how the unarisen investigation of Dhamma's awakening factor can arise, and how the arisen investigation of Dhamma's awakening factor can be perfected by development. Okay, so I'm going to read that again, a little more briefly. I'm going to take out a little bit of the repetition. So you got the of Dhamma's part. I'll just say investigation, okay? So if the investigation awakening factor is present in you, you know this. If the investigation awakening factor is not present in you, you know that too. You know how the awakening factor of investigation can arise, and you know how the awakening factor of investigation can be perfected. Okay, so you're tracking. Is investigation present? Is it not present? If it's not present, how can I encourage it to become present? And if it is present, how can I develop it further? See, the Buddha was trained in the Brahmanic tradition of philosophy and clarity of thought. And you see this again and again, a kind of very analytic thoroughness. And in a way, it's very simple. It really boils down to a simplicity. Is it there? Is it not there? If it's not there, how can I get it going? And if it's going, how can I make it even better? Right? That's pretty useful. So what is this investigation factor? It sounds like what Sherlock Holmes will do, or CSI, or, you know, like, what's the FBI? I don't want to talk about the FBI these days. But anyway, like, what's the point of all this? So investigation has two qualities to it. One is a quality of inquiry. We are looking. And we are also applying that looking primarily to our own experience. That's the fundamental domain of investigation. Now, our experience is representing material reality, you know, chairs, people, bills, what's happening in a relationship. But the primary attention to that is not so much what's happening out there in the material universe, but what's happening in the mind as it represents the material universe and has reactions about in the material universe, and also has reactions about mental phenomena, pure and simple. So you're coming down into your own experience. You're coming into your own subjectivity, your own phenomenology. That's the primary domain of investigation. The Buddha's not against investigating in his time how to build an ox cart skillfully or how to count rice. You may have read the book Siddhartha, which is a kind of Hermann Hesse fictional account of the Buddha. And there's this, for me, really funny passage in it where the Buddha has decided to take a break from his ascetic practices, the young Buddha, and he goes to get a job. So he's educated, but that's about it. And he goes to see this grain merchant who starts asking him, well, what can you do for me? And there's something about this kid, the young Buddha, that the grain merchant is interested in, but he can't figure out why he should give him a job. And finally, he just bursts out. So he says, can you load sacks of corn? No, sir, I've never done that. Can you control horses? No, sir, I've never done that. You know, can you whatever? And he said, well, what can you do? He says, well, I can think. I can fast. And I can wait. That's it. But at least you can think. At least you can investigate, you know? So at least that's something we could do. Okay, anyway. So we're investigating our own experience, right? And we're fasting, maybe not fasting, but waiting, what have you. So that's the target of inquiry. So investigation has an inquiry aspect. We're teasing apart our own experience. We're looking into it. We're feeling into maybe the hurt or fear under the anger. We're tracking maybe the turbocharger of our previous life experiences that are revving up our reactions to being stuck in traffic or having some kind of wrangle with somebody else. we are becoming aware maybe of the space between the thoughts. We are watching what happens when something's pleasant and we want to hold on to it. We're observing when it's unpleasant and we want to fight it or complain about it or blame others for it or find fault with ourselves about it. You know, we're looking into the details. We're teasing apart the threads of the tapestry of experience. So there's an inquiry aspect to investigation. The other aspect of investigation is discrimination or discernment. Discernment. And discernment primarily is very pragmatic in this tradition. It's the discernment about, is what's happening there that I've recognized through my inquiry, my teasing apart, my uncovering, it's an uncovering process, is what's happening there wholesome and skillful in terms of progress on the path? The framework here is this is a factor. Investigation is a cause of development, of enlightenment, of awakening. So there's a progressive process. If only the uncovering of what is already our ground of being as Buddha nature, awakened, heartfelt, loving, lived by something unconditioned. All right. So we're trying to see is what's happening in the mind wholesome and skillful. Wholesome and skillful. We get to decide what is wholesome, right? And maybe our view of what's wholesome or unwholesome is somewhat shaped by our culture and our background, but there's probably a fair amount of convergence, even around the world, on that which is wholesome. My wife asked me to check out some bacon that had been, so yeah, there was some bacon in our house. She likes the bacon. But anyway, so there was some bacon there, and we were somewhat omnivorous. So she asked me to give it a sniff to see if it was wholesome, right? One of the arguably first emotions that evolved in creatures with a nervous system was disgust, in which can also be transferred, hopefully skillfully, into more of the moral domain, where we're tracking, is this unwholesome or wholesome? And also, is what's happening in the mind through discernment, is it skillful? Is it helpful? Is it making me and helping me to be happier, more peaceful, stronger, and wiser? Or is it making me grumpier, tearing me down rather than building me up, making me tighter in the heart, meaner spirited? Am I becoming more like Scrooge? Or who is the other one? Jack? Or the good person? You know, in the Christmas Carol, Dickens?
Tiny Tim?
Really? The singer? Oh, well. Okay. Oh, yeah, that was the kid. No, Tiny Tim was the kid. I'm thinking of the adult, the dad of the kid. Okay, but you get the idea. What's it doing to me? Is it good or bad? You know, there's a traditional saying, your mind takes its shape from what it repeatedly rests upon. Well, modern update, based on the fact neurons that fire together wire together, what we repeatedly rest our attention upon, for better or worse, becomes kind of our nature, right? What do we repeatedly rest our attention upon, ruminate about, dwell on, you know, and eventually become? So that's the discernment factor. It's very pragmatic. Helping, hurting, happy, suffering, loving, hateful, wise, confused, and so forth. Okay? So far you see the basics. So we have this idea of investigation. We're investigating primarily our own experience. With training, we become more and more granular in our clarity about our experience. We see it on a smaller and smaller scale of sort of aspects of experience like sensations in the body or subtle distinctions between emotions, or we track, okay, that's the meaning piece of it, the meaning my mind gave it. Those were the intentions I attributed to others. That's how I praised the situation. That was more like the cognitive part. Then there was the body sensation part. Then there was the emotional part. Then there's the desire part. You know, then there's more like the sense of enactment, behavior part, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are these different parts. So we get more and more granular. You could think of it as sort of granularity of space. You know, what's there, right? And we also get more granular about time. We start being able to recognize mental events on a shorter and shorter time scale. 2 or 3 mental events per second are pretty discernible. With some practice, maybe even a few more sometimes. And we get more and more also in real time with our investigations. Less and less retrospectively, like, oh, that's what made me so mad in that whole situation. But we're tracking in real time the process of getting mad right here and right now. Okay, so that process happens. And then, so we're applying it to our experience with a quality of inquiry. It's an active process. We are investigating. We're not simply mindful, which is a kind of sustained, receptive, present moment awareness that has a certain inertness to it, mindfulness itself. Alongside mindfulness could well be other things, such as self-compassion or acceptance or investigation. In other words, there's 7 factors of awakening, not just 1 factor of awakening. Mindfulness is among them. It's the foundation of the rest of them, but it's not the only thing to do. So there is this active quality of investigation that is really guided by discernment. What's helpful to you and what's not so helpful to you. Okay? So that's the basic. And now I want to nominate or mention a couple of targets of investigation that you might find helpful. I've certainly found them very helpful. One target is summarized in a saying that a friend and teacher of mine, Gil Fronstall, mentioned to me one time. I asked him, you know, what are you doing these days in your own practice, Gil? What's really fundamental for you? That's always a good question to ask people, especially if you think they've been at it longer than you have, right? Hey, what's your practice these days? What's your growing edge, right? He said, I stop for suffering. Wow, like a stop sign. I stop for suffering. Certainly suffering in other people. Stop for suffering. So he's discerning suffering. But especially he meant it especially in his own practice, that when he recognizes a certain quality of tension, even subtle, or irritation, or worry, past the point of sort of useful vigilance or recognition of I better take care of something, he could start to watch the contraction of getting into a bit of a wrangle with his partner or his kid or his Dharma Center board, you know, life, right? If his, you know, body is not feeling well, maybe he's working too hard, there's something edgy or not quite right, wonky, you know, in his own body, whatever it might be, he's going to stop for that suffering. Isn't that wild? Stop for suffering and look at it. Doesn't mean run away from it. Doesn't mean to try to stop the suffering. He didn't say, I stop suffering. He said, I stop for suffering. And in our own experience, it's really easy to blow right by our own personal suffering, to just go right by it. Deny it. We don't admit it. We hope it'll get better if we ignore it. Often we internalize attitudes toward ourselves based on how others treated us, especially when we were young. If they did not stop for our suffering, why would we stop for our suffering ourselves? I made a joke. It was a joke. Maybe it wasn't funny. It was intended as a joke. I joked with my wife one time. I said, honey, I don't care how I feel. Why would I care how you feel? No, I didn't mean it in a horrible way. I was making fun of myself, you know, a guy, whatever. But my point is, you know, you just think about that. Like, if they didn't care how you felt, why would you care how you felt, right? If they didn't stop for your suffering, why would you stop for your suffering? See what I mean? And if you just think about it, to slow it down, to be gentle, to be sweet with ourselves, to feel it, like, ouch. This hurts, I don't feel good, something's missing in my life. Maybe I can't do anything about it, but at least I can bow to my suffering. I see you. The first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. As you may have heard me say, Some modern scholars translate the word noble as ennobling. In other words, there's a kind, it's ennobling in some ways. I think that's true, to face our suffering, to open our heart to it, to sense down into it, maybe to talk with ourselves a little bit, you know, honey or whatever, you know, you're suffering. It hurts, doesn't it? It's so profound. I think of the dignity in suffering. You know, people who I respect a lot, Native American First People, elders, people in general in around the world, social activists, people who are speaking up for others who have suffered a lot themselves. There's often a dignity. People who have health problems, who have cancer diagnosis, who are dealing with something really hard, or maybe they've lost a loved one, or they're in the throes of a situation they don't want to be in. They don't want to be in the middle of a divorce, but they're in the middle of a divorce. For whatever reason, there's a kind of dignity in stopping for suffering. Right? We slow it down. We feel that there's been a lot of suffering related to the recent election, the U.S. presidential election. You know, kind of stopping for that in oneself and feeling into it. That's a really important thing to investigate. Maybe alongside that investigation are other things like compassion for oneself, or maybe some insight about ways that our suffering might be more self-constructed. Maybe we're getting our knickers in a twist about something we don't need to. Maybe there's a practical problem to solve that I really should go see a doctor or the chiropractor or, you know, talk to my partner or my kid about that. Okay. That's alongside, though, this very simple, very heartfelt, very sweet holding of our own suffering, you know, in the hands of awareness. Okay. I'm thinking of a saying from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, no mud, no lotus. You know, suffering is the mud, right? And a lot of wisdom and heart opening can come out of that mud. I had a spiritual teacher for a while. He said, keep the wound of the heart green. By green, he meant open, fresh, you know, the wound of the heart. Keep it green, keep it open. Compassion, what's the word? A friend of mine said, suffering tenderizes the heart. You know? In Chinese medicine, I believe in the five elements, bitter opens the heart. Bitter nourishes the heart. So that's the first one I wanted to say. A second place to investigate is craving, the second noble truth. And particularly its subtleties. Craving sounds really big. Like, okay, it's not that I'm jonesing for heroin, okay, or something like that. But in a subtle way, maybe there's a kind of insistence on being right. You know, that I need to make my point. My son and I had a little exchange today on email about, you know, one take about the election and a different take about the election. And from 100 yards, the difference between my take and his take is invisible. But up close, I could feel the way that I wanted to push my point. You know, I was attached to it. I was a little hooked on it. Happily, I was on top of my game, maybe because I was about to come here tonight, and I lost the battle, but I, for the sake of winning the war, forgive the metaphor, you know, I kept my dad hat on, usually a good idea, if not always a good idea. But you can feel the subtlety of craving. You know, it's really quite amazing that the Buddha, 2,500 years before Freud, developed a drive theory of suffering. This notion of drive, of motivation, of attachment, of, you know, grabbing or pushing away or clinging to, or wanting to just bypass, spiritual bypass too sometimes. You know, paying attention to that, paying attention to the feeling in your body when you feel a little driven or contracted or insistent or you gotta have it. There's a must in your mind. That's a second very, very useful thing to investigate. So much suffering comes from being unaware of this machinery of craving, broadly defined. So that's the second thing in real time. That's been extremely useful for me in the last few years to really track and pay attention to the second noble truth, the ennobling truth of awareness of craving. That's a second suggestion. And then my last suggestion, just in terms of something that I think can be very fruitful to investigate, is kind of the ground beneath it all. You know, we can get really caught up in the hall of mirrors that is our own mind, you know, and lose sight of, well, what's the base or basis already of the mind as a whole or kind of reality as a whole? What's really the foundation? You know, like you can see, you look out at, like right now, you can look at the room, I'm looking at the room, and you see all these faces and shapes and details. But if you kind of back out a little bit, you realize, oh, all those little parts are one gestalt. They're one whole. It's kind of like you can get really close to a painting and you see the little dots. But then when you back out, you realize, oh, it's one painting. It's one whole. All right? You can look up at the sky and you see all the detail. This cloud here, that bird there, jet trail going by, blue, dusky. Okay? But then you back out, you go, it's just the sky. And it's really easy to lose sight of the ground because the brain wants to focus on the figure, especially friend or foe, right? Is it going to eat me or am I going to eat it? That kind of thing. And it's very powerful, actually, to kind of, another version of this is a Tibetan meditation where instead of meditating on things, you meditate on the space, not in some cosmic sense, but more like a physical volume in which things appear, right? Like we, in this room, we probably don't pay much attention to the sense of the volume of this room in which all kinds of stuff is, including ourselves, and you know, all kinds of activities are occurring. But what's the context? What's the space? What's the ground? And you can do that in your own mind. And it starts becoming very remarkable. You get a sense of mind as sort of wallpaper or mind as a whole. And when you open into mind as a whole, a really interesting thing happens. You disengage from parts tussling with parts, which is the structure of any kind of stress or worry or irritation or resentment or problematic desire. You kind of boop, boop, come into mind as a whole. And mind as a whole, embedded in life as a whole, or embedded in the body as a whole, embedded in nature / biology / life as a whole, culture as a whole, reality as a whole altogether. You know, see what I'm saying? And it might start kind of conceptually, but you just start investigating, like you go, wow, that's really true. All these little parts are happening, and there's always the whole that contains all of the parts. Even without getting mystical about it. And maybe for you it's meaningful to go ultimately into that transcendental that can really contains all of the parts, infuses the parts, is at some in some sense the nature deeply of the parts. Right? But minimally, you can go into mind as a whole and go, wow, there really is mind as a whole, including the awareness aspects of it, including the point of view aspects of it. Nothing left out, no part privileged. Investigating and dropping into mind as a whole, arising and you know, passing away dependently upon ultimately reality as a whole. That's a really neat investigation. Okay? So I'd like to investigate what you make of investigation. Comments, questions, anything so far? Wow. Is this really abstract, or it is pretty abstract? But the idea of investigation—you know, inquiry, uncovering, coming down into the body. What else am I feeling? What's going on? What did I really want? That's another real good one. What would I really want? Yeah.
You mentioned keeping the pain green, or keeping the
heart green, open.
Maybe you difficult often not to slip into self-pity.
Okay. What's the difference for you between self-pity and self-compassion? Well, the words are, but what's the difference, actually?
My heart is open. My heart is.
In self-pity, your heart is closed, or?
Well, it's crying.
What's so bad
it's
about
really
self-pity? Well, this.
I think you can get stuck in.
Yeah, that's what I really get. And thanks for putting up with me, putting you on the spot. You know, I was investigating a little with you right there. So you're saying for the group, sometimes when you go into the wound of the heart, it can feel like, woe is me, self-pity, self-pity, self-pity. And then I asked, wow, what's the difference between self-pity, which the implication is that that's bad, and self-compassion, which people generally accept, oh, okay, that's probably a good thing. Tara Brach thinks it's a good thing. Okay, I'll go with it. You know, something like that, right? Even Oprah thinks self-compassion is a good thing. All right, so what's the difference? And what I'm hearing you say in self-pity, for one, there's a kind of wallowing in it, right? Like you get stuck there. And there can be a way in which we get caught up in that. On the other hand, if we're suffering and compassion is a response to suffering, maybe it's okay if there is some continuity to our own self-compassion. Maybe it's more prominent sometimes in others, more in the foreground, sometimes in the background, depending on how bad it is. But if your back is continuously killing you, or you're feeling continuously sad at how someone has treated you, maybe there's a place for continuity of compassion directed toward yourself as well. And, you know, in my own personal view, I've looked into this word pity, like why did that word become such a bad word? And I think pity and compassion overlap each other tremendously. There can be a way in which pity can have a quality of superiority. And that's, okay, let's leave out that little part. But let's retain what's beautiful about it. And also, with regard to self-pity, it can have this quality of taking things very personally, right? And that, I think, is a distinction between self-pity and self-compassion. Self-pity often tends to personalize it. You know, how, like, why did they treat me that way? You know, me, and so forth. Whereas compassion is, honestly, it has a little bit more of an impersonal quality to it. You know, there is suffering and there is compassion, but it doesn't need to be so me, you know. And then just the last, yeah, one more little detail about that, then I want to see what else is here. I find, actually, that if people feel the self-compassion, or in the wholesome sense, the self-pity, and they really receive it into themselves, the need for it tends to fall away pretty quickly. So maybe one reason why self-pity is a place we get stuck is we're actually not feeling it, but self-pity is a disguise for the case we're making in our mind for how they've done us dirt. It's a kind of form of resentment or case making. You know, I've been cheated and mistreated, when will I be loved? I've been cheated and mistreated, when will I be loved? You know, see what I mean? So it's not actually self-compassion. It's more like, you know, a view we have. And so see if you're exploring this, what it's actually like to receive into yourself that sweetness of compassion for yourself. And when it lands, often, the, you know, chasing of it can fall away because message received. Yeah. Okay, yeah, a couple. Yeah.
What is the difference between investigation and inquiry, and is there any difference, really?
Okay. My understanding of this meaning of investigation is that it involves inquiry guided by discernment.
Okay. I don't get that.
Oh, okay. So I like right here, right now. So you said that to me, and I just watched my mind in real time. So, you know, I watched this initial, in the first half second, startlement arise, okay? And then I watched this kind of micro freak out inside me arise, like, ah, what did I say, ah? And then I watched this other thing come up, which was, it's okay, Rick, she's cool, it's no big deal, we're all right. You know, and all that was like 1 second, you know, and that's real time. You can, you know, do a little practice, you're there, you're in the moment. That I call the beginning of investigation.
Okay.
And I also looked in kind of fairly quickly under the surface of my reaction to, you know, am I feeling insecure? Is there an insecurity that's turbocharging my response to you right now in real time? You know, is there a defensiveness there? And I looked and went, no, there really wasn't. It's okay. So that would be a kind of inquiry in real time. Now, that's based on something that's happening in the moment. Other times, there you are, you're sitting in meditation or on the bus, and you notice something is in your mind. Maybe you notice that you're bothered by something. Your mood is slumped. And you go, why is my mood slumped? And you look more closely and you know fairly quickly, oh, I'm still preoccupied with that weird little interaction I had with my partner on the way out the door. And then you investigate further, what was going on in that interaction? You know, and what's happening in my mind now about it? Oh, I tried to push it away because I'm evolved and I'm not supposed to feel anything, you know, or is that useful? Then the discernment factor comes in. You know, is that actually useful? Oh, actually, it's not very useful. I don't need to do that, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's like an inquiry process guided by investigation, guided by discernment is what I mean. Is that clear, the distinction between the two?
So is an investigation, is that something that is always triggered by an event, by something that is happening, and I want to know more about it? Is that investigation?
It's a great question. So sometimes the investigation is based on something's happening, right? Often, we're just sort of hanging out, and we're kind of curious about our mind. One of my major teachers, in a way, Joseph Goldstein, was once asked, you know, what has really served you in your own life of practice? He said curiosity. There's a curiosity. And in particular, we're trying to track suffering or not suffering, right? You know, craving or not craving. And we're trying to investigate and have insight into. We develop insight through investigation. So Vipassana, insight is useful, we develop it a lot through investigation. Yeah, I have found for myself that I fundamentally, for me, and I bow to the altar of truth. Like, that's what I want to do, the altar of reality. What is actually true? So in a sense, you're bringing that to your own mind. What is actually true? Past the spin, past the hoping it's this way or hoping it's that way, what's actually going on inside your mind? That's what investigation's about, basically. I mean, it can sound kind of complicated, but it's pretty straightforward. What's going on? What's the deeper level? What might be really happening? Slow it down, tease it apart, you know, like that. Okay.
And then inquiry?
Well, that investigation, that is an inquiry.
Yeah. I feel like it can be used like exchanging the one against the other, no? An exchange?
If I follow you right, and I wonder if I'm not getting what you're saying.
Almost synonymous, I want to say.
Almost anonymous?
Synonymous.
Oh, the word investigation in this context has two aspects to it. Inquiry, guided by discernment. So investigation is the umbrella term that has two aspects to it. And you can see the distinction between, you could inquire, but if you don't have discernment, it's not going to have much value. Or you could have discernment, but if it's passive without inquiry, it's not going to have much value. but the two together are what is meant by investigation. That's great. I'm glad we went through that. Yeah. Yeah. Even if I was startled in the beginning. See? It's okay. So now we're a bit past 8:30. I know there are a few more people, but I want to just see if I could move quickly here. Yeah. Rob.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about self-pity and compassion. Well, self-pity is kind of an isolating tool.
Oh.
You know, where you find that this is me, as you were saying, this is me alone here in this horrible spot, where self-compassion, to me, is an awareness that we all have this.
Beautiful.
We all have
common humanity.
We have a common humanity.
Yeah.
And right now, even though I'm hurting, I can join with that commonality that we all share.
Yeah.
We all suffer over love.
Yeah.
It's inevitable.
Yeah.
So in this moment, with a little bit of inquiry, I can share that universal quality as self-compassion. It's more of a joining.
Yeah.
Where self-pity is more of a stab of isolation.
Great, thank you.
An anthropologist's view anyway.
Okay, beautiful. That's very helpful. Okay, a couple more, then we'll wrap up. Yeah.
So this pausing and inquiry.
Do you mind speaking up a little?
The pause.
I can tell already you're going to say something good.
The pause for the inquiry and for the investigation.
Yeah.
It's fantastic because when you start on the investigation, the knowledge that comes from within it is just you have a thirst for it.
Yeah.
And I find it kind of ironic, thirst itself is, you know, it's kind
craving, tanha,
suffering.
Yeah.
So when I begin to apply it to like self-reflection, that's when fear came, you know.
Yeah.
Because when I started to peel back the layers, you know, you find some really, really good stuff, and then you find some stuff that brings a lot of fear.
Yeah.
It opens a lot of doors and little pathways within yourself, and you say there's this hall of mirrors up there. Well, the quicksilver begins to just, you know, melt away, and you see through these things, yet sometimes you lose your way. I mean, it's kind of it's a double-edged sword. You know, the investigation, you like what you see, and then sometimes it really reveals things.
That's really true. Thank you for saying that. Yeah, and that's, I think, also where this is a great point. How do you resource yourself so you can tolerate what you find when you investigate? You know, turning over stone after stone. I was thinking about how when I was younger, people would say to me in the human potential scene, Rick, feel your feelings. I was like, are you crazy? My feelings hurt. I don't want to feel my feelings, you know? I didn't want to open to them. So, no, that's really right. And that's where things like understanding why we do it come in, having discernment, realizing, okay, this is the purpose, being able to apply compassion to ourselves, maybe have some skillfulness about letting go or holding it in spacious awareness. Exactly right. Exactly right. But it can also become kind of delightful because you start discovering more amazing dimensions to your own neurosis. You know, like, wow, that really, wow. You know, you just kind of shake your head at a certain point, not out of, you know, self-hatred or getting into some kind of Woody Allen endless self-analysis, but more like, wow, what a zoo, you know? So anyway, and then, okay, then you take it less and less personally. And with the wonderful thing, I'll close on this metaphor because I think it's a useful one. What's great is that you don't have to clear every neurotic engram in your head. You don't have to clear every entanglement because I think there is no perfecting the mind. Those little weeds, those little nutty things, they will come up faster than we can pull them, right? And there's a kind of peacefulness if you get that. You go, it's not about transforming every single bit of content in the mind. Over time, the content does seem to get happier, wiser, less afflicted, less addictive, less driven. All right, but you can't transform every bit of content, but you can disengage from it and see through its nature as transient, impermanent, empty, insubstantial, incapable of lasting happiness, not to be identified with as self, not to be taken too seriously. You can become disenchanted of it, waking up from the enchantment. right? That's really quite profound. And then the metaphor of that quickly is that we find ourselves in a forest of suffering, and we want to get to the mountains of happiness, okay, wisdom, awakening. What do? Well, do we need to cut down the whole forest or just make a trail? We just need to make a path for ourselves. That's profound right there. Second, how do we make that path? We could cut things down with a razor, but it's not very powerful. Or we could get a big stick, whack them, bing, bing, to make our way. But it's not very sharp. But if we combine the sharpness of discernment, insight, clarity, with the heft of intention and effort and sincerity, we can then form a like razor-sharp machete and cut our path to liberation. Isn't that a beautiful kind of metaphor? And to do that, of course, you have to kind of keep investigating. You know, what's going on? Where am I? What's helping? What's hurting? Am I using my machete skillfully? Is this a particularly big tree? Can I kind of step around it? You know, what can I do? Then we keep going. Speaking of Joseph Goldstein, he said to me once, you know, these two words, I've really thought about them ever since, kind of after he was kind of acknowledging with me that, yeah, I was getting something. He looked at me and he said, two words I'll pass on to you here. Keep going. How about we sit for a minute, then we'll keep going home. Thank you very much. I apologize for going long. I'll end on time next week. See you then.
This is the chair.